Welcome to WMKV Health Scope, a weekly discussion of health and wellness issues for older adults, their families, and caregivers. This call-in program is presented by 89.3 WMKV. To have your medical-related question concerning today's topic answered live on the air, call 513-772-9658. That's 772-WMKV. And now, WMKV Health Scope. We thank you for joining us for Health Scope here on WMKV and WLHS, the Maple Knoll Radio Network. We're streaming around the world at WMKVFM.org. We are going to learn today about something called GERD, G-E-R-D, and we have a very special returning guest who has been here with us before, Dr. Valerie Williams. She is an assistant professor of surgery in the Division of Thoracic Surgery at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She is here with UC Health and our good friends at UC Health. Deb, thank you for bringing in some wonderful guests here. Dr. Williams, first of all, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk for just a moment before we actually get to GERD, and we'll try to talk as much as we can about many of the topics under GERD, and we'll find out what GERD is for those people who are just joining us here. We're not talking about the lumps in cottage cheese. That's curd. We're talking about G-E-R-D. But Dr. Williams, first of all, how did you come to this area of medicine? It's a fascinating area and one that has really boomed in the last maybe decade.
Well, I've always had a particular interest in diseases of the esophagus, and GERD, or gastroesophageal reflux disease, is a disease of the esophagus. It's a disease where you have a reflux or return of acid or food from your stomach up into the esophagus where it doesn't belong. You normally have a valve or a sphincter at the bottom of the esophagus that creates a barrier to reflux. But when that valve becomes defective or weak, you can get reflux of stomach contents into the esophagus, which can cause symptoms. And when it causes symptoms, and those symptoms occur on a daily basis, we call it GERD.
Very good. That's once again, gastroesophageal reflux disease, right?
Correct.
Boy, will there be a quiz later?
That's right.
we call it GERD for short, which makes it a lot easier for the lay people like me on this. Now, do we get these symptoms? And let's cover some of the symptoms that are there. Obviously, anybody who's taken even a basic chemistry course knows that acid can have tremendous ill effects on things. I mean, it can eat through things and all that. Your stomach produces a certain amount of acid, correct?
Yes. Your acid is meant to be in your stomach.
Right.
It's meant there to digest proteins. And the stomach has a special lining that protects it from acid. But when the acid goes into the esophagus, which has a different lining, that can cause damage. You can get inflammation or something called esophagitis. You can, over time, if it's not treated, get strictures or narrowing in the esophagus. And you can ultimately, over time, if not treated, get changes in the lining of the esophagus that can potentially be precancerous.
And I know you deal with everything from, and I'm going to take my best shot at this. You get to chuckle. You know, the radio guy gets to do all the knobs and dials here, but now I get to try to pronounce things like VATS lobectomy, right? I got that one right.
Mm-hmm.
Laparoscopic anti-reflux surgery.
Yes.
Minimally invasive
esophagectomy.
Thank you very much. Esophagectomy. So you work on a lot of these, and we're going to discuss, I guess, some of these here today.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I treat all diseases in the chest, so we treat a fair bit of lung cancer, but also as far as esophagus, a big component of our work is with reflux disease and cancer.
Now, if we live with this, and a lot of people say, oh, I can live with this. I'm having it every day. They say I can live with it. What kind of damage can this actually do to the esophagus?
Well, as I mentioned, it can cause irritation of the esophagus, and it can cause changes that eventually can lead potentially to a cancer. You know, the initial treatment is medical, and so often patients will self-treat yourself. I mean, if you go to any grocery store or drugstore, you see a whole aisle of antacid medications.
Right.
So, and a lot of people will self-treat themselves, and that's fine. But if you're doing that on a recurring basis, you should eventually see a physician and get that evaluated, because it may be something worse than just run-of-the-mill reflux. You may have changes from the reflux, and you don't know just by blindly treating by yourself.
And we'll come back to exactly what causes GERD. But is there a threshold at which it becomes GERD as opposed to just an occasional heartburn?
Right. It varies. It varies. So usually what we say is a daily basis for a long period of time. So probably continual over 3 months period, you would probably seek the help of a physician to make sure you don't have anything underlying. And that's when we probably would consider it gastroesophageal reflux disease, as opposed to occasional heartburn. Everyone overeats, they get a little heartburn, they eat the wrong type of food. But when it happens on a continual, routine, daily basis, those are the individuals that we call GERD. And probably about 30 to 40 million Americans suffer from chronic symptoms.
Wow.
Daily symptoms.
And for some people, they may experience this in the middle of the night. Maybe they wake up with that heartburn or something like that. Maybe they ate too late or ate something really spicy. Or maybe it wasn't that. Maybe it's just stomach acid that's kind of getting back up into the esophagus. But for some people, it happens during the day. It doesn't have to be while you're reclining or anything. It can happen anytime.
Right. It often happens around meals, but it doesn't have to. So, you know, people who get it intermittently once in a while may have had a big meal or had something spicy, may get some heartburn. Patients who get it routinely, it's usually around meals. But if you eat a meal and go lay down at night, people will describe regurgitation of fluid coming up into the esophagus. Heartburn, which is burning sensation in the chest. You may have a cough. You may have hoarseness from reflux causing irritation of the vocal cords, chest pain. All of those things can be related to GERD.
In fact, I've heard, being in radio, that there are some people who have vocal issues.
Yes.
And one of the things that they try to rule out fairly early on, if you're having vocal cord irritation, is GERD.
That's correct.
Because that acid, I guess it's even just the fumes in out of the acid can get up there and annoy the vocal cords. And I mean, you wake up coughing or with an irritated throat in the middle of the
night. That's correct.
Wow, that's interesting. We are here talking with Dr. Valerie Williams from the UC College of Medicine, and we are talking about GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease. Did I get pretty
close?
Right.
You
okay,
got it.
Good enough. Okay. I'm checking myself on these because, you know, radio people, we're not good like over three or four syllables. So, you know, I'd like to buy a vowel here, or in this case, a vowel. But anyway, so let's talk about what causes GERD, though. You talked about the fact that there is kind of this closure or sphincter that closes up at the top of the stomach. Is that supposed to keep things from coming up and going the reverse direction?
Yeah,
from?
So normally, in the normal human body, there's a valve at the bottom of the esophagus. And when you're not eating, it's closed. At rest, it's tight, it's closed. And when you swallow, the food goes from your mouth to the esophagus, and that valve relaxes or opens to allow the food to go through, and then it's supposed to close again. When it does, it's weakened, it has a lower pressure, or it doesn't completely close, if you will, as your stomach distends after a meal, that acid or food can, it's more easy for it to come up into the esophagus. And certain foods will weaken the resting pressure of that valve. So it's all those good foods that we like, right? So peppermint, chocolate, caffeine, acidic foods, they actually all weaken the resting pressure of that valve.
I had no idea.
Yeah, so if you already have a little bit of a defective valve, a valve that's not working, and then on top of it, those foods can exacerbate it and allow you get the symptoms, the heartburn and the fluid or food coming up.
Do we have any idea why these particular foods seem to aggravate the issue?
They decrease the resting pressure for whatever reason of that valve.
So that valve, and again, the valve kind of, I guess it has kind of muscle memory or whatever. And
correct.
If it's constantly, if it gets more relaxed and more relaxed, or it can't stay constricted, I guess, if you will, it then starts to relax and stay more open. And that's when things start coming the wrong way.
Right. And the other common reason for a defective valve, besides it just being weakened or shortened, sometimes it shortens over time, is often patients will have something called a hiatal hernia. And that's where part of the stomach inches its way up into the chest. And so that valve is sitting not in the correct spot anymore. Ooh. Normally it sits kind of at the junction between the esophagus and the stomach right before right in your abdomen. But if the stomach slips up into the chest where it doesn't belong, that valve's in an incorrect position and it's under different pressures, and that can also lead to defective valve and reflux.
I was going to ask one other thing before we get to some of the initial treatments. Mm-hmm. In fact, you have a brochure here mm-hmm. on something called Lynx, which mm-hmm. literally it looks like a little ring. Mm-hmm. In fact, on the cover of the brochure, we'll talk about that in just a moment. But for those people, there are some people who say, well, I'm just afraid I'm going to have a degree of acid reflux. And almost prophylactically, they take an antacid or something, maybe before they go to bed mm-hmm. or if they recline or they're in kind of a weird position where they're not upright right after eating or something like that. Is that something people should be doing?
Yeah, I mean, the initial treatment is medical, right? Mm-hmm. We don't jump right away to surgery. So lifestyle changes are the most important thing. And if you go to your doctor and talk to them about reflux disease, they're going to tell you to avoid the foods that cause the problems, elevate the head of your bed at night so you're not having fluid or food coming up in the back of your throat. Wait at least 3 hours before you lay down mm-hmm. for the food to digest and go down to the remaining part of the digestive tract. Quitting smoking can affect that valve. Obesity, being overweight, you have more of a pressure from your belly that can create
kind of pushes down on the stomach and pushes things up.
That's right. So with all those lifestyle changes can make a difference. And then if that's not working, we often go to medication. So that's the acid suppression medication that either you get over the counter or your physician prescribes for you.
So once again, there are many different types of treatments. And then I would imagine for some patients, when either lifestyle change or, as you said, the medication modification doesn't seem to work, there are surgical procedures and things that can be mm-hmm. done. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
What options are there for people?
So, I would say most patients with lifestyle modifications and medications can control their symptoms of reflux. But there's probably about 20 or 30% of patients that maybe just have escalating doses of medication. They have to take it twice a day and at bed. And even with that, they're getting breakthrough symptoms. So for patients that have only gotten a partial relief to medication, or maybe they say their heartburn's gone away, I don't have heartburn anymore, but I bend over and fluid comes up in the back of my throat. Mm-hmm. For those patients, surgery is an option. And there are two main surgical options. The conventional surgery has been something called a funduplication. That's another big word. It has a lot of vowels in that one. And that's where we take the top of the stomach and actually wrap it around the bottom part of the esophagus to recreate that valve or recreate a functional valve. The other procedures are relatively new. It's a device that's FDA approved, and it's actually exactly what you describe, which is a band of magnets. And the magnets are in titanium beads, and the beads are connected by a titanium wire, and it's placed around the lower part of the esophagus, and they're closed, and that augments or supports the valve. So when you swallow, those beads actually separate to allow the food to go through, but they cause enough strength to prevent reflux of the stomach contents as your stomach distends.
It's almost like a steel belted radial sphincter.
That's right. It's an artificial sphincter. It is.
I mean, it's there. It's that extra support. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it just compresses it a little bit more gently, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Gently compresses it.
But it actually doesn't compress it. It's kind of just on top of the tissue.
Okay.
And when you swallow, it separates, but it creates more of a pressure that the stomach would have to create to overcome the magnetic force to create reflux.
So the magnets really are the key here because they kind of draw to each other.
That's right.
That's pretty cool.
But you create enough pressure from your swallowing above to still have food go through.
I'm always amazed on this program. We have Dr. Valerie Williams here with us. She is assistant professor of surgery in the Division of Thoracic Surgery at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She's here along with UC Health, which you can find out always more at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital, or you can reach UC Health and find out about any of their physicians at 513-298-DOCS, D-O-C-S. And that is also, if you don't like poking around looking for the letters, that's 298-3627. And if you would like to join our conversation here today, you can join us here on WMKV. Maybe you have a question about GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease. You can call us at 772-9658. That's 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658. Is it a hard G in there? Is it esophageal?
Esophageal.
Good. Mm-hmm. So I was doing it right. Yeah. Okay. Here we go. But we're talking about what causes GERD. What are some of the treatments? Yeah. And again, we kind of talked a little bit about what that threshold is. And I would imagine it's different for every person. If it starts really affecting the viability of your life, in other words, you're not able to sleep at night because you're getting this kind of reflux and it's waking you up night after night or maybe even several times a night, there's something bigger going on that you really should be talking to your doctor about.
Yeah, often it will affect your quality of life, and that's what we're talking about. You know, it affects your quality of life. Patients often say that they're tired at work the next day because they've been up all night coughing and choking from their reflux disease. Maybe they can't, you know, eat the foods they want to. They're often running to the bathroom occasionally where mm-hmm. food and fluid comes up to that extent. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, initial medical therapy and then surgery if that is not adequate. When we have a chance, when we were mentioning the links, there are some benefits of one surgical procedure over the other, because this device has it's quite revolutionized, I think, treating the disease.
Do you think this will become kind of the new gold standard?
Well,
for
I think it slowly is. It is a new device, and the mm-hmm. one of the biggest benefits is it does not change your anatomy. So, as I mentioned before, the fundal application, you have to alter the stomach. This, you retain all your natural anatomy. There's minimal dissection, and one of the biggest benefits of this compared to the stomach wrap, which is our conventional surgery, and patients still get that.
That's the fundal application.
That's the fundal application.
Gotcha.
That's right. Is that after a fundal application, you're not able to belch or burp.
Oh.
And so.
My wife would love you.
And so you tend, I don't know. You tend to pass more gas from your bottom instead.
There goes that.
And most guys like that, but
there's
women
a trade-off,
not too much.
Yeah.
So you can get gas or bloating type symptoms. With this device, the ability to belch and burp is still retained.
Because
all that air you swallow has to go someplace.
Also, how about the invasive quality of the two different surgeries? Is there a difference in how invasive one is versus the other?
So both are performed through small incisions. But mm-hmm. inside, like I said, this one's less invasive in related to the fact that you don't alter the anatomy. So you don't burn any bridges, if you will. If for some reason you had this device placed and it needed to be removed, it could be removed and you still could go on to a fundal location. You can't go on the opposite direction.
Gotcha. And once again, how long do these last? Do we have any idea? Are they pretty much good for a lifetime?
These are rare earth magnets and are meant to last a lifetime.
Now, the one that we're looking at here is something called the Lynx. It's called a new treatment for chronic reflux disease. And it literally is, it looks like a ring. That's pretty amazing stuff. And so this can be done almost, is it laparoscopically?
Laparoscopically,
inserted?
Small incisions. Most patients go home the same day. And also, unlike the kind of conventional surgery, patients will go right away to a regular diet. So you can go home and have regular foods. The other surgery, you kind of have to be on a soft diet for a while because there's a certain amount of swelling that takes
irritation,
place.
Irritation, sure.
But patients go home right away to a regular diet. And I'll tell you, instantaneously, most patients, over 90% of patients are off their medicines. Over 90% of patients no longer have their symptoms, especially heartburn or regurgitation. They are very, very pleased. They're very, very pleased with this.
From the standpoint of somebody who might be a candidate for this, if they're not able to treat this, and again, for those people just joining us, and we have people at lunchtime here kind of literally passing through the radio dial and maybe just finding us, this is not the first be-all, end-all.
No.
This is this is maybe third in line after lifestyle changes, after medication.
Right.
Then you might have to get into some kind of a surgical alternative. But it's really important to first discuss this with your doctor and not just go and say, give me that thing that's the ring.
Right. And you also want to have an evaluation. So if you're going to consider surgery, you want to make sure you do indeed have reflux disease. So if you haven't had an upper endoscopy, which is a camera going into the esophagus to make sure there's none of those precancerous changes we talked about or complications of reflux. Sometimes patients may need a pH study or a study to document that you really do indeed have reflux disease, particularly if medications haven't done any help. So if medications aren't helping you at all, you have to wonder, is this reflux? Is this heartburn? Because often you'll get at least some response to that.
I was going to ask, too, I think there are a lot of people that listen to us who travel. Because this has magnets in there, is it something where they have to disclose if they go through?
Good question. So, you know, we put a lot of devices in, right? Pacemakers, heart valves. And it does not make any thing go off going through the metal detectors or anything in the airport. However, we do give you a card, just like you would if you had a heart valve or an artificial
hip.
In case of a situation where something would arise.
Or if
question,
the wand goes off,
that's hypersensitive or something. But it shouldn't. And you know, candidates for surgery for the Lynx, you can't have a really large hernia. So if you have like half your stomach in your chest, some patients have very, very large hernias, then the conventional surgery is recommended. You have to have either no hernia or something small less than 3 centimeters. You can still have an MRI. You know, that's another question, is magnets, right?
Yes.
So you can still have an MRI with this, but it has to be what we call a low-dose MRI. They were originally worried that the magnets were going to, you know, kind of fly out if you had the... but that's not really the concern. The concern is more that make sure the magnets still function.
Exactly. You don't want it to malfunction.
That's right.
You fix one thing while trying to diagnose another.
Right. And they do still function. And so it is compatible with a low-dose MRI if you were to need one in the future after having that device.
Very good. We are here talking with Dr. Valerie Williams, and we're learning about Lynx, which is a pretty cool thing that is magnetic sphincter augmentation, actually, the Lynx. And we're also talking about fundoplication, which is literally, I'm trying to envision how you do this to create this new valve. And I somehow have this vision of tying off a balloon or something, but I'm sure that's not it. But trying to imagine how fundoplication works.
Well, it's actually just taking the top part of the stomach, and it's almost like you're creating a collar, like the collar around your neck. But the stomach is the collar of tissue that goes around the bottom part of the esophagus. So when you eat a meal and your stomach distends, that collar of stomach gets tighter. So that's essentially how it works, so that you recreate that valve, if you will, to prevent that acid from coming up into the esophagus.
When we're talking about GERD in general, is this something that people can have a natural predisposition to? Is it a matter of aging for some people? What are the aspects that might make us more inclined to develop gastroesophageal reflux disease or GERD?
So that's a good question. You know, if you have a hernia, that can be age-related. So over time, the tissues can weaken, the diaphragm can weaken, and the stomach can kind of wiggle its way up into the chest where it doesn't belong. But there are also some genetic components. Often patients will say, I have almost every, you know, family member I know has a hiatal hernia. And so there may be some tissue strength there, and that may be a genetic component, at least related to a hernia. When you don't have a hernia and you have a defective sphincter, that's a little bit more gray area. We don't completely understand it, but it is thought that you may have reflux, and the reflux causes a weakening of the valve, and after you have a weakening of the valve, you get more reflux. So it's kind of a vicious cycle. One begets the other. What comes first, the reflux or a weakened valve, the chicken or the egg? We're not 100% sure.
But either way, getting any of that acid back up into the esophagus is really not a good thing. Even short term, it's irritating, if nothing else.
That's right.
Possibly could cause swelling, things like that. Longer term, again, some people will say, I'll just live with this. I don't want to bother going to the doctor and all this, but it can lead to bigger things.
Yes.
I know you mentioned that at the very beginning of the program, but I think that's something we need to echo throughout this show, that living with constant heartburn can mean that there's something bigger going on, and also it could lead to other complications to the esophagus.
That's correct. And some of the listeners may have heard something called Barrett's esophagus. We often hear about this on commercials and such. And that's where you have chronic reflux, and it can change the lining. It actually changes the lining of the esophagus. You get a change, and that's called Barrett's esophagus. Those patients who have Barrett's esophagus need to be watched a little bit more closely. If you have Barrett's, you probably have a 40-time increased risk of developing a cancer as compared to someone who doesn't have Barrett's, okay, or a normal esophagus. And that doesn't mean that everyone with Barrett's gets cancer, but usually those patients need to be followed more closely with every 2 or 3 year endoscopies, which is the camera that looks down and makes sure you're not developing any cancers.
As a thoracic surgeon, I have to ask this, and I'm sure this is something that you may deal with every week or maybe at least every year. What happens if somebody does develop some esophageal cancer? Mm-hmm. What kind of treatments are even available for that?
So it varies. It varies on when it's caught. You know, if caught early, oftentimes there are a variety of what we call endoscopic modalities that can treat the cancer. But oftentimes, if it's not early, it does require a large operation, which is actually to remove the esophagus.
I mean, you have to have that to be able to eat, right? Do you
right.
have to insert, like, feeding tubes?
No.
Or what happens?
So interestingly, we actually make your stomach into a new esophagus, if you will. So the stomach, we create the stomach into a tube, and the stomach gets pulled up into the chest to make a new, quote-unquote, esophagus.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it is pretty neat.
And we have enough of our, I know I probably have enough in my stomach because I'm overweight, but there's enough stomach there to
yes.
be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, wow.
And depending on the stage of the cancer, sometimes chemotherapy or radiation
sure,
is needed
sure.
in combination with surgery, either before or after. It really varies. If caught early, surgical intervention or endoscopic intervention is usually curative. So that's why it's important, like you said, if you're having persistent symptoms, to get that checked out.
We have Dr. Valerie Williams here with us. We're going to take a quick break here on HealthScope. By the way, if you would like to join the conversation here on Monday afternoon, 513-772-9658. Our toll-free number, long distance, 877-772-9658. We're talking about gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD. I may pick her brain about some good eating habits, things to avoid. We've already mentioned a few things about not like laying down right after eating. I don't think that's good for anybody, whether you have GERD or not. It's probably not a good thing. I want to ask you too, maybe this is a wild card topic, but like, can stress add to all this? We'll talk about that in the second half of the program here. It is HealthScope right now on WMKV and WLHS. A big thank you to UC Health. They are at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. You can find out more about any of the physicians and services at UC Health at 513-298-DOCS. That's 298-DOCS or 3627. The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or its staff and management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not meant to be taken as specific professional advice. If you're just joining us, we are here on HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS. Our numbers again, 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658. We're talking about a very important topic today. It is called GERD, G-E-R-D, gastroesophageal reflux disease. Dr. Valerie Williams is a return guest here with us. She was here a few years back, and we welcome her back here on behalf of UC Health at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital or 298-DOCS. Dr. Williams,
yes.
One of the other things I forgot to ask about in the first half of the program, you mentioned the hiatal hernia.
Yes.
Is it possible that the hiatal hernia could be causing those symptoms of GERD in that case? And sometimes can fixing the hiatal hernia
yes.
fix the problem?
That's correct.
I forgot to ask that.
Yes. So the hiatal hernia can cause the weakened sphincter because the valve is moved in a different position because the stomach's in a different position, right? The hiatal hernia is when part of the stomach slips up into the chest, kind of where mm-hmm. it doesn't belong. And so when we treat reflux, if you have a hiatal hernia, that is fixed at the same time. In other words, the stomach is brought back down to the belly where it belongs, and then the anti-reflux procedure is performed. So fixing the hernia, which is the cause of the defective valve and the cause of the symptoms, would fix your symptoms.
Dr. Williams also specializes in everything from lung cancer, esophageal cancer, airway surgery, minimally invasive surgical procedures. VATS lobectomy. Mm-hmm. What is VATS lobectomy, if I could ask you while we're there?
Sure. VATS is video assisted thoracoscopic surgery. So it's small incisions in the chest. So similar to laparoscopic surgery,
gotcha.
Which is small incisions in the belly, but it's in the chest. And lobectomy is when we actually take part of the lung out. That is mainly for lung cancer. So mm-hmm. we do minimally invasive surgery for lung cancers.
And you also do minimally invasive laparoscopic anti-reflux surgery that
Correct.
We've talked about. Even the I'm sorry, I'm trying to find my term here again. The one where we tie the stomach off.
The fundoplication.
Yes, mm-hmm. When you do the fundoplication, mm-hmm. is that done laparoscopically as well?
Correct.
Wow, yeah. Really?
And for many years, that was done as an open operation.
That's what I was thinking, is you have to be able to get in there and do that, but I imagine now with laparoscopic mm-hmm. tools, you can do this kind
it's
of thing?
It's essentially small incisions and a camera. So we go in with the camera, we have long instruments, and you know the belly is kind of blown up with some air, and you can get up to that area and do everything you need to do. And of course, the turnaround and the recovery is much better than a bigger incision, right? So there's less pain. Patients often go out of the hospital quicker, maybe be in the hospital for one day or less. And they're back to their normal activities faster.
And one of the other things that I think a lot of people don't think about when you talk about a laparoscopic surgery and using that very small incision, because you're not only going through just the fat here in this area, but also the muscle wall. And
correct.
There's a lot to heal. So the smaller that incision, the better and the quicker the healing, correct?
Yeah, when you have a larger incision, there's obviously a higher risk of getting an infection in the
exactly,
incision.
Yes.
A higher risk of that incision breaking down and getting an incisional hernia, so a different type of hernia, where those layers that you mentioned break down and you can get bowel up into that hernia or up into that incision. So the smaller incisions, there's less chance of a hernia, less chance of infection, less pain. All around, it's much better.
If somebody passes all of the tests that you were talking about to make sure that they indeed have GERD,
mm-hmm.
Is there some kind of criteria that would say, well, I can't really look at doing something like the Lynx, the magnet, the sphincter augmentation?
Right. So if you've had other prior intervention on your esophagus, so mm-hmm. you've had surgery on your esophagus already or your stomach, then you would not be a candidate for the Lynx. If you have a complication of reflux disease, such as a stricture or a narrowing in the esophagus, you may not be a candidate for the Lynx. Also, if you have a very large hernia, so as I mentioned, I might have mentioned before, a small 1, 2, 3 centimeter hernia is okay. But if you have anything larger than that, you're not indicated for the Lynx. And the main reason for that is it hasn't been studied in that group of patients right now. The whole point of the Lynx is to preserve and do very minimal dissection and preserve as much of your normal anatomy as you have. When you have a very large hernia, in order to repair it, you have to unfortunately disrupt, or that anatomy is already disrupted. And so it's really to preserve your native and anatomy that you already have that you would be a candidate for the Lynx.
Well, you talked also earlier in the program about the fact that when you do lifestyle modification, which is, again, the first course of action.
Absolutely.
For somebody who's not in severe issues here.
Mm-hmm.
Is it good to keep a food log if you find that you're having some of these issues? Does it help at all before you go to your doctor to say, well, I kind of find that when I eat certain things?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think you need to identify, everyone's different. So, you know, keeping a diary of what foods give you symptoms, if the pizza, the pepperoni pizza is from Domino's or whatever is what gives you the acid reflux, then you probably should avoid that. Most people, it's pretty memorable, is, oh, I know I eat this food, but keeping a diary doesn't hurt. And it's sometimes hard to avoid all those foods, because even it's normal foods, not necessarily these spicy foods or the chocolates or the coffee. It's not always these foods if you have a fairly weakened valve. It can be anything you eat for some individuals.
Right. But sometimes it could also be combinations of foods. Or I know that there are even some oral medications, like some pain relievers and things like that, or if you're on a prescription medication where it says take this with food, I imagine a big chunk of that could be because it could cause irritation, could it not?
Well, sometimes it can cause irritation in the stomach and you kind of get indigestion. May or may not cause reflux, but yes, sometimes those medications can cause the burning sensation in your chest. Also, I think avoiding eating too much. You know, we often our eyes are bigger than our stomach, right? So we eat until we're stuffed.
Right, and so, we go to places that serve the bigger portions.
That's right.
This is a phenomenon, I think, in America,
right,
of all places.
Right, so, eating smaller, more frequent meals and not overeating can sometimes prevent over-distension in the stomach and reflux the contents from the stomach into the esophagus. Not avoiding tight-fitting clothing. Sometimes if you have something real tight, a tight belt or something, that can exacerbate food from
it's
the
just
stomach.
Putting more
That's
pressure,
right. Exactly.
More pressure on the
That's
abdomen
right.
and things. What about stress? I have to ask, and if you don't feel comfortable with this, sure. that's fine. But can stress add to this? Will it really be an effect one way or the other on whether
Some patients say that they have more reflux when they're stressed. Now, whether they may produce more acid in their stomach, that's certainly a possibility. Whether they eat more when they're stressed, and so you eat more and you tend to reflux more. Stress can affect every organ in the body, so certainly stress can be a contributing factor. But you know, and that I think it. If you have a completely normal valve, you should not have a significant amount. But if you have an underlying, maybe a little defective valve, it's not working like it should, and on top of it, you're stressed, you make more acid, you overeat, then, yeah, you're maybe more likely to get symptoms of reflux.
Very good. Dr. Valerie Williams here with us on WMKV and WLHS. The program is HealthScope. Again, if you have a question about gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, or something in that general realm, we're here taking your questions today at 772-9658 or 877-772-9658. If I suspect that I have GERD and I'm getting ready to either go to my regular doctor or to a specialist, maybe I'm about to talk to a surgeon about some other options, what kind of information should I bring with me? What do you need to know about me as a patient if this is something that I'm looking at, or I at least want to discuss options?
Sure. I mean, I think it's important to know how long your symptoms have been going on. You know, how have you been self-treating it? You know, how long have you been taking the Tums or the over-the-counter? What medications have you been taking to treat it? You know, what are the times that you get the symptoms? Is it mainly at night when you're laying down? Is it after meals? You know, have you had any other prior procedures? Have you ever had an endoscopy? So if you've been seen under other physicians, what other procedures have you had to further evaluate it?
Now, you mentioned the endoscopy. I imagine that's one of the tests that might be done to kind of see what's going on down there. I mean, you have to be able to gauge whether this is really GERD, whether there's some other issue. What are some of the tests that somebody who gets to this level where, again, lifestyle change isn't working, medication is not working, or at least not working well enough, and now I'm possibly a candidate for surgery, what kind of test should I be expecting?
So if you've had some partial relief, you've kind of optimized everything, and maybe you've had relief of one symptom but not the other, you're right. An endoscopy with possible biopsy if there's something concerning to rule out underlying problem or changes. Occasionally, depending on the symptoms, a patient may have something called a pH study, and that's to measure the amount of acid actually in the esophagus. There are a couple different ways that's done. One of the common ways is the pH probe that's actually placed during the scope. It's a little capsule. It's called a Bravo capsule. It's actually placed within the bottom part of the esophagus. And the patient goes home and you have a little pager. And it actually transmits and it sees what your, if you will, what your esophagus sees. So it transmits any acid drops to that pager, and then when the pager is returned, we can get that information from it. It's typically a two-day test, and you can see what kind of exposure you're having. That's sometimes done.
And that little Bravo capsule, this too shall pass,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, that's right. And then it doesn't need to be retrieved. It kind of just sloughs off on its own, and you don't need to be capturing it from below or anything like that. So that is one test. Sometimes patients may have something called an esophagram, which is an outpatient procedure that's done in the radiology department. It's where you swallow some contrast and they take pictures and photographs while the contrast is going through the esophagus. It's more of a functional study, gives an idea of how the esophagus contracts, if there's a hiatal hernia present, how the contrast goes through the esophagus into the stomach. The final test that may be, if you're seriously considering surgery and pretty much done routinely on anyone who has an operation, is something called a manometry or a motility disorder. Essentially, it's a test to measure the function of how your esophagus contracts.
So the peristalsis or
that
whatever
peristalsis, that's
see,
that's
I remembered
right.
that from...
That's right. So normally esophagus should contract in an orderly fashion, right? From the top
kind
to the bottom.
Pushes
to
things
squeeze
down, right?
things down,
exactly.
right? And so you have to have enough strength, and it has to be in a coordinated fashion, not just everything mm-hmm. contracting at once, a coordinated
right.
from top to bottom.
Or spastic or
that's
anything
right,
like that.
Right.
Yes.
You don't want any of that to make sure that after a surgery you wouldn't have problems with difficulty swallowing. And so that test is also an outpatient procedure, and that's pretty much routinely done regardless of whether you're looking at a lynx or a fundoplication.
Very good. Now, you mentioned already on the fundoplication some of the side effects and the fact that if you do that where you kind of pull the stomach up, make this new valve a little bit, that you really can't burp, things like that.
Now, often patients will say that they can't burp or belch or vomit, for that matter, as well. And so all that air that you swallow,
it tends to
go the opposite direction, not below. But you can get gas or bloating type symptoms. And the lynx allows you to still burp and belch. The other thing is immediately after a Nissen or a fundoplication, sometimes you'll hear the term Nissen. That's the type of fundoplication.
Okay.
You may hear that.
Is that
N-I-S-N-E-N.
Okay. Yeah. Just in case somebody would hear a physician bring that up.
Right.
Good.
And I forgot what we were saying.
We were talking about the side effects.
So if you have a fundoplication, there's a certain amount of swelling because you're manipulating the stomach, and oftentimes you're on a soft diet early on. And it can take a good 6 to 8 weeks for all that swelling to go down, but eventually the goal is to get to a regular diet. With the lynx, you're not manipulating the stomach or any of the tissue, and so you go right away to a regular diet. Either procedure has a period where you may feel like stuff kind of hangs up a little bit as things heal in. With the fundoplication, it's early on, the beginning part. With the lynx, it actually happens about a couple of weeks later. And that's because the body actually forms a natural capsule around the device. And we just encourage patients to kind of eat through it and exercise the magnets, if you will, and
you
stretch them.
You get to eat more?
That's right.
Oh,
we encourage
wow.
you to actually eat every few hours to kind of exercise that.
But eat smartly.
Right. Yogurts or bananas or something soft to kind of make sure it continues to move during that period where the body's kind of incorporating it. Once that period passes, you should be able to eat regular diet. Well, you're eating the regular diet the whole time.
Sure. When we were talking a few weeks back about the lower part, the large and the small intestine, the colon health, a big thing was made about fiber and things like that. Does fiber in any way, shape, or form help or do anything to improve any kind of GERD symptoms?
Not really, other than making your whole system function more appropriately. So if you're backed up in your colon, your stomach's not going to, everything's going to get kind of backed up. You know, your stomach may not empty as fast. If your stomach doesn't empty as well, you may have more reflux because things back up in the esophagus. But not so much, fiber doesn't so much influence the actual GERD per se.
We have Dr. Valerie Williams here with us on HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS. She is assistant professor of surgery in the Division of Thoracic Surgery at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. And we're talking today about gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, and just in general about some of the good stomach and also esophageal health. And again, if you're getting that heartburn, even on an occasion, but especially if you're getting it every day, that can be the sign that you want to look into this. Would you suggest if somebody's getting this just now and then to at least mention it to their regular physician?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you've never had evaluated or if you've been self-treating, I think your primary care doctor or your GI doctor are good doctors to start with if you've never actually had it treated before. To talk to you about those lifestyle changes we talked about and make sure you're on the appropriate medication, appropriate dose. Making sure that there's nothing that maybe it's not GERD, maybe it's something else. And so you want to rule out something that maybe you're thinking it's GERD and it may be something that's a consequence of GERD.
What kind of symptom improvement will we see? Let's say we have the I keep losing my term here. Fundoplication.
Yes.
That's it. I don't know why I want to put an L at the beginning of that. Fundoplication. If we have that done, if we have, let's say, the lynx put in, which is, again, the magnetic sphincter
augmentation.
If we work with these, do we generally see almost like 100% improvement?
So about 90% patients are completely off their medications after that. And that's a big plus because a lot of, you know, long-term patients do have concern about the long-term effects of being on their acid medications.
Mm-hmm.
As far as symptoms, the typical symptoms like heartburn, regurgitation, and difficulty swallowing, if the difficulty swallowing is from the reflux, 90% or higher symptomatic relief with both procedures. Other symptoms, what we call the atypical symptoms, like cough and hoarseness, there's a little bit more variability in outcomes after surgery for those symptoms. And the reason for that is because cough and hoarseness and those types of symptoms can often be multifactorial, right? So you can have a cough from postnasal drip, allergies, asthma, you know, voice overuse. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons. And so that's when we often tend to do a little more of a workup to try to prove cause and effect between reflux and, say, your hoarseness or your cough, which can sometimes can be hard to prove. And so the outcomes after surgery for that type of symptom are a little bit more variable. But the classic symptoms, heartburn, regurgitation, and difficulty swallowing, you know, pain in the chest, that burning, they're very good outcomes for that.
And I can only imagine the mindset of somebody who says, well, I don't have any allergies, I'm not having postnasal drip, I'm not overusing my voice, I'm not whispering too much, I'm not shouting, yet I'm having hoarseness and all this, and you check, there's no polyps or anything on the vocal cords, and, you know, a lot of people aren't thinking, you're thinking what's dropping down toward the vocal cords, but few people think about what's coming up from the esophagus into the cavity in the head here.
Yeah, and it's often those patients that will do a pH test to get objective evidence, right? So you have this symptom, but objective evidence is that, we're seeing an abnormal amount of acid exposure in the esophagus. And if you're not having any of those others, and often the patients will have been evaluated by an ear, nose, and throat doctor. They've seen a lung doctor or a pulmonologist. They've seen their primary care doctor. Oftentimes, you're right. It's not thought of a reflux disease, but that can be a significant contributing component.
Well, we have Dr. Valerie Williams here with us in the final moments. In fact, we can still squeeze a phone call in if you'd like at 772-9658 or 877-772-9658, our toll-free number. I just want to ask you about some just good, I know you're not necessarily here as a nutritionist or anything like that, but just some good habits for eating. One of them, I'm sure I can do some of these, our brilliant grasp of the obvious, but I just want a physician to tell us here. Reclining right after eating. Does that hurt anything? Does that create issues?
Yeah, I think, you know, waiting several hours before you lay down to allow the stomach to empty and digest is important in general, but particularly in patients who have reflux. You know, eating appropriate size meals, having a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner, maybe even more smaller, more frequent meals, and not overeating. And of course, you want to have a balanced, healthy diet, right? So foods high in fat and spicy foods and those type of foods. You want to have a balance of vegetables and meats and the usual appropriate, you know,
things
balance.
In moderation.
That's right. Things in moderation.
And I would imagine dovetailing with the reclining after eating. And some people don't count like laying back in a recliner as reclining, but that can create the issue. Maybe not as if you're perfectly horizontal, but it can still create issues. What about late night eating? I mean, again.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, late night eating is similar. Most people eat late. What do they do right after that? They go to bed. So more of the late night eating is that you're going to go to bed right away. So if you're eating at 10 o'clock at night, unless you're going to be up till 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning, then it's probably not a good idea.
And also, again, can just poor nutrition affect our overall esophageal and stomach health?
It could, not so much, but I can tell you smoking and alcohol can affect the health of the esophagus. You know, the most common cause of esophageal cancer in the U.S. actually is reflux or GERD. It used to be smoking, and that caused something called squamous cell carcinoma, and the most common type of cancer nowadays is something called adenocarcinoma, and that comes from reflux disease. But smoking can still affect how that valve works, can cause cancers, and same thing with alcohol, because it's a caustic injury to the esophagus, especially alcohol, can cause an irritation, and you can get changes in the stomach or the esophagus from alcohol or smoking.
And we have a wide gamut also of listeners age-wise. Mm-hmm. How, as we age, do we have more potential for stomach and esophageal issues? I know some people, I was talking to a gentleman the other day, he says, man, I used to have what he called a cast iron stomach. I could eat anything. Mm-hmm. Now, oh man, I can't eat the spicy stuff anymore. I can't eat this or I can't eat that. What role does aging play in this whole thing?
Well, I don't know that it's so much the age rather than our bodies change. So if you gain weight as you age or the tissues weaken as you age, that can affect how everything's functioning together and cause more indigestion perhaps or reflux. I will tell you, if you're younger and you have symptoms of reflux, you're going to live a long life. You have more chance of having complications of reflux than someone who gets reflux when they're 65. Right? It's just as concerning, but if you're 40 and you've had reflux for 10 years already or since your 20s, well, you have a lot more years ahead of you that you can have reflux and constant bathing of acid and damaging contents into the esophagus. And so when you're younger, we tend to be more aggressive about reflux and may even consider surgery earlier because you have so many more years ahead of you that could be potential damage.
Yeah, the prolonged problem can become a very big issue.
That's right.
Even if it's a small problem at the beginning.
That's right.
We have Dr. Valerie Williams here with us. Dr. Williams, we're down to our last few minutes. I wanted to leave a few moments in case you had some other points you would like to make about this. We've That's easy for me to say. We've talked about some very important issues today involving gastroesophageal reflux disease. We've talked about different surgical options. What are some thoughts that you have? Where would you, and if you don't have any additional thoughts on that particular thing, where would you like to see all this headed, let's say in the next 5 to 10 years?
So I think over the last couple decades, we've had a much better understanding about reflux, particularly about the valve and the anatomy. And that has led to new technologies such as this Lynx. And, you know, this is probably about 5 or 6 years old now. We have more than 1,000 patients worldwide who have the Lynx device, the magnetic sphincter augmentation. And I think our understanding of how the valve works and shortens and weakens has allowed this to evolve. I think our awareness of the damage that GERD can cause has allowed us to detect cancers earlier and be more aware, and people to be more aware and cognizant of seeing their doctor if they have symptoms. So I would encourage that if you have persistent symptoms, if you've been self-treating or you're still having symptoms, to make sure you are just not treating yourself and you see a physician and make sure you're getting the appropriate treatment and everything's being evaluated thoroughly.
Very good. I thank you so much for taking time here with us today, and we certainly wish you the best of luck moving forward. Again, you can find out more about Dr. Williams, any of the physicians with UC Health, at 513-298-DOCS. That's 513-298-3627. Dr. Williams, thank you again. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You can also find out more at UCHealth.com. And you can do / Westchester Hospital to find out more about the Westchester Hospital location, especially for all of our listeners now in Butler and Warren County. So we welcome them. And you can check out uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital, or again, 298-DOCS. You've been listening to HealthScope here on WMKV and WLHS. Thanks for being with us today. You've been listening to WMKV HealthScope. Join us again next Monday at 1 p.m. for another edition of WMKV HealthScope on 89.3 WMKV Reading, Ohio.